I'd like to call the meeting to order. The February 13 Environment and Natural Resources Committee. We are having a joint committee today, and Representative Bill Hilty, the chair of the Energy Committee, and the members of the Energy Finance and Policy Committee are also with us today. It is an important presentation that we're going to be hearing, starting off with Dr. David Tillman, who's a Regents Professor of Ecology at the University of Minnesota. We'll also be hearing from Dr. Ed Nader today, a professor and the head of the University of Minnesota Department of Soil, Water, and Climate, and also Cheryl Miller, the project coordinator for the Minnesota Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative. We're going to be starting with Dr. David Tillman. Thank you for joining us today, and we're going to be holding questions until the end of Dr. Tillman's presentation. He's going to have to leave a little early, I guess by 5 o'clock, I understand, for a plane trip to Washington. So with that, I'd like you to begin, and again, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Chairman Eakin and Chairman Hilty. It's my pleasure to be here, and representatives, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to talk with you today about some of the research we're doing and some of the broader implications of this work and other work being done around the world on renewable energy issues. I'm going to look mainly at what are called second-generation biofuels, if you will, the future that we think is ahead of us 5 to 7 years from now, but look at them through the window of what we're achieving right now with our current biofuels. So, just to briefly summarize this, we are having this discussion for a variety of reasons, one of which, as we know, is that the global demand for energy has increased sharply in the last 30 or 40 years. It's doubled in that time, and it's going to double again in about the next 40 years. The same thing is happening for global demand for food. It doubled in the last 35 years, and the projections are it is on a course by both production and by demand to double again in the next 50 years. At the same time these things are happening, we are seeing sort of the footprint of humanity upon the Earth and the impacts of this upon the ecosystems that provide vital services to us through climate change and other impacts. So if you will, we have really three needs that we're trying to address with biofuels. The need for energy, the need to be able to also simultaneously sustain the food supply the world needs, as well as having a way to address some of the major environmental challenges we face during the coming 50 or so years, especially global climate change. Well, in looking at these, I want to first mention where we stand right now. I want to show you where we stand on current biofuels. These are corn ethanol and soybean biodiesel. As you'll see, they are both successful biofuels. They have developed to the point now where each of these gives us back more than we invest in it. So it takes a lot of energy to produce corn ethanol, but we actually gain more. So I want to have you sort of look at this slide for a minute. And so the first two bars on the left-hand side show corn, and one of the bars labeled output is the energy we get from corn ethanol. And the bar right next to it on the right-hand side is the energy we have to put in. This is fossil energy we have to put in to grow corn and convert that corn into ethanol. The difference between those two, shown by the red arrow at the top, is the actual net amount of energy that we gain by growing corn and converting it into ethanol. And so what you can see is that growing corn requires quite a bit of energy, which is a pink bar on the bottom there on the left-hand side for corn ethanol. And it takes even more energy than that to convert that ethanol, to convert that corn into ethanol at the processing plant. The net effect is that about 20%, and the high estimates are 25%, but about 20% of the energy in a gallon of ethanol is new energy. The rest of it is basically all the fossil energy that had to be burned, used, to grow the corn and convert that corn into ethanol. Now, shown next to it is soybean biodiesel, and there you can see the same sort of figures, and that arrow is a bit shorter there. This is showing gigajoules per hectare, how much energy there is per hectare. Let me put these numbers in perspective. That red arrow for ethanol is about 80 gallons of net energy, new energy, per acre for ethanol production. we actually get about 400 gallons of ethanol from the corn grown on an acre. But when you subtract all the fossil energy we had to combust to grow the corn and create the ethanol, we end up with about 80 gallons of net energy gained ethanol produced from an acre of corn. We get a little bit less than that in energy units from an acre of soybeans, but we should realize is that soybeans are mainly protein. The main reason they're grown is for the protein in them, and so there's a much lower sort of energy, usable energy content in the soybean from the soybean oil. If you look at it another way, you can ask, how much are we gaining? For soybeans, we actually gain 48%. So 48% of the energy in a gallon of soybean biodiesel is new energy, compared to 20% for corn ethanol. Now, I want to make one more point about these, and that is there's a lot of talk about how we might be able to meet a large portion of the U.S. energy demand with biofuels. I think there's great potential to do this, to meet a significant portion, but not the way we're doing things right now. Corn ethanol and soybean biodiesel are first-generation fuels. We have net gains for them. The gains are pretty small. In fact, given those gains, if we took the whole U.S. corn crop, converted it to ethanol, we'd be able to make enough ethanol to displace 12% of the gasoline we currently use, but only 2.5% of that would be new energy. So in essence, we're only able to get rid of 2.5% of the energy we currently combust in gasoline with new energy from growing corn for ethanol. And it's about the same for soybeans. We'd be able to we would produce in the whole U.S. enough soy biodiesel to get rid of 6% of our diesel use, of which 3%, half of that would be new energy, not fossil energy. So better biofuels are possible. It'd be nice to grow to produce fossil fuels with low inputs of energy, which also includes the energy content for fertilizers and pesticides. It'd be nice to produce them on land with lower value. As you know, there have been impacts of high use of ethanol and corn prices. In some ways, it's great. Farmers had not been getting very fair prices for their crop. Now they're getting a very large price, but corn is an internationally traded commodity, and higher food prices here affect the people of Mexico City. I'm sure you saw the reports on the demonstrations in Mexico about the increased price of tortillas, a staple of the Mexican diet, especially for people on the lower end of the economic ladder there. So there's some impacts here. It'd be nice if, as we ramp up our biofuel production, we don't produce so much of it on agricultural land that we'll greatly elevate the price of food in ways that have impacts on people around the world, especially those who are most needy. It'd also be nice to be able to have biofuels that have a better impact in reducing greenhouse gases. I didn't show the slide here, but for your information, if you burn ethanol made from corn and measure throughout its whole life cycle, once you've actually combusted it in the car, its impact on greenhouse gases compared to the same thing for burning a gallon of gasoline, the energy equivalent amount of ethanol burned only reduces greenhouse gases 14% relative to what you would have had if you burned gasoline. It's a reduction. Biodiesel gives you a bigger reduction, about 40%. They both reduce it a bit, but they both are carbon-positive biofuels. They both are causing net increases in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The lowerings are there. They have a benefit. What we have to do is find ways to make those benefits much larger than they are right now. Well, if we look at it, in Minnesota, there is quite a bit of land that could be used for biofuel production. We have 1.4 million acres of CRP land, Conservation Reserve Program land, that is planted to grasses that could be available for biomass production for biofuels. And around the whole U.S., there's about 35 million acres of land that could be used in that way. So there is a land base out there, a land base that is not currently being used for food production. And then you can ask, what might you plant in this land base? And I want to quickly talk about some of our work on this issue. We grew a variety of native prairie species, 16 different species, by themselves. So we could look at how each species performed, and then in different combinations, two species together, four, eight, or 16 species together. And I'm only going to give you the one graph summary. I don't know how lucky you are. I normally present much more data than this. And this shows the data for every single plot. And what you can notice is that the monocultures, this shows how much energy they produce, and the one that refers to plots planted with a single species, the monocultures produce, the units don't matter here, it's a scientific talk, it won't make any sense. But I guess the important part is look at how the one species plots did versus the 16 species plots. The high diversity plot, the plot that was planted back to a diverse mixture of legumes, grasses, and then other flowering prairie plants, produced 238% more energy per year than did the typical single species plot. And in fact, the dot there is the average for three different plots planted with switchgrass, which is one of the poster grasses for energy production, if you will, and it's right at the average. And so growing switchgrass by itself. Now, this is grown with low inputs on infertile soils. So this is sort of a worst case to some extent. These are degraded lands, lands that have been set aside from agriculture because they weren't very productive. But what you can see, there's a huge premium from biological diversity, a huge premium, this 238% more bioenergy by growing mixtures together than by any one species. The little lower graph on the bottom shows something else. That shows what has happened in a county in Kansas where instead of tilling the fields, many, many farmers have just mown them for hay year after year, starting in the 1880s or so. And this shows how much yield there was of hay year by year over a 55-year period, which I could find the data. This is yield of hay in an area. They never fertilized it. They didn't irrigate it. They didn't apply pesticides. Just went out and mowed it for hay. And what you can see, yields go up and down, but the long-term trend is no significant change. They're not becoming less and less productive. They have highly sustainable productivity, never need to be replanted. Plant it once, let it grow, harvest it year by year by year. It's a very simple system that minimizes energy inputs and provides a sustainable flow of biomass on these degraded lands using the benefits of biological diversity. So you can ask, what can you do with this? Well, there are three major ways you can convert this biomass into energy. One is by directly combusting it. That could be done co-combusting with coal, for instance, for electric generation. The biomass doesn't have sulfur, so it has lower sulfur than coal, has very little sulfur, doesn't have mercury like coal has. And as I'll show you, it actually it causes a net decrease in the greenhouse gas emissions from a coal-fired plant, both because the carbon dioxide in the plant was just recycled from nature, and because when you grow it, as I'll show you, there's carbon stored in the soils that gives a benefit. Or it can be pelletized for these home heating pellet stoves, which are becoming increasingly popular. So there are two ways it could be directly used that way. It can also be converted into ethanol by what's called cellulosic ethanol production, where the cellulose in the material is digested into sugars. You've probably heard this so many times, I shouldn't repeat it too much. And the sugars are fermented, and then it's just like making corn ethanol. Or it can be gasified and then used to make synthetic transportation fuels, gasoline and diesel, transportation fuels, as well as electricity. So what I want to show you now is what you gain when you do this. This shows the net energy gains. This is the amount of energy available above the fossil energy that had to be invested to produce this energy. So if you look at the total energy in your end product, corn ethanol or prairie electricity, whatever it might be, subtract all the energy it took to produce the biomass and to convert it into this energy source. This is a net gain you have, the real gain, new energy for society. And what you can see, the first two bars show corn ethanol and soybean biodiesel, the two numbers I showed you before, the actual gains. And those are for crops grown on fertile soils using the mean yield for those crops in the corn and soybean growing area of the Midwest. The next three bars show the energy gain per acre growing high diversity prairie biomass on infertile soils. And what you can see is that you essentially gain as much energy growing prairie biomass, or more if you gasify it per acre than you do on corn, even though the corn is grown on more fertile soils. Now, this is another way to look at it. This looks at the usable energy that comes out from each of these processes divided by how much fossil energy that goes in. It's really sort of a return on investment. It's the energy return, the new energy that you get back for a unit of fossil energy that you invested in the process. A ratio of 1 means there's no return. I'm hoping you can see those numbers. They're smaller than I viewed them, as I thought, I imagined they would be. I apologize for that. But a ratio of 1 means no energy return. So they're all above 1. But when you come out to peri-synfuels, the ratio is about 8. 8 times more usable energy delivered to society than the fossil energy that has to go in. It's one of the biggest multipliers that is out there. That's for a peri-biomass turned into synfuels. But a ratio for peri-ethanol of 5 or so is also a very wonderful return on energy invested by society. Now, this is one side. This is how much energy we can get. The other side of the question are, what are the impacts of producing this energy? So what does society gain or lose in terms of, let's say, climate change or other impacts of the energy production? I just want to give you a couple of terms. So if you look at a fuel source, it could be what's called carbon positive. And that means that when you, in total across the full life cycle of that fuel, from finding it to making a usable fuel to combusting it, the net effect is that greenhouse gases go up in the atmosphere. So carbon dioxide and other gases go up. It's also possible for fuels to be neutral, which means that in the whole life cycle, when you use that fuel for energy, when you're done with all of that, you have no net effect on greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And it's possible for fuels to be carbon negative, whereby their use, their production and use, actually leads to lower levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and other greenhouse gases. Well, let's look at something about this that's relevant. I've got to give you a little ecology lecture, soil ecology lecture here, and excuse me, my colleague, Ed Nader, who does this, he's the real professional, but I will give a brief lecture here. Soil is the second largest biologically active storehouse of carbon in the whole world. There is twice as much carbon as organic matter in the soil as there is carbon in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So, there's a lot of carbon, as we know, in trees and plants. And so growing trees and the forest ecosystem can remove and store carbon dioxide from the air. The plants will take the carbon dioxide from the air. They use the carbon to make their tissues. Plant biomass is about 40% carbon by weight. But those are big stores. And by understanding what controls the size of these stores, we are able to manage these ecosystems in ways that can remove carbon dioxide from the air and sequester it in soil or in biomass in a way that helps overcome some of the release of greenhouse gases that we have. So this soil is very important, is that because soil has in it twice as much carbon as occurs as carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and even more is than in all living plants. Well, as a soil forms, and this looks quite different on your now than it used to look on my screen. Soils are formed by the organisms that live in the ecosystem. And what you might be able to see this should be a solid line, there's now some dots, I apologize for that. But as soils form, they have more and more carbon building up in them. This is carbon removed from the atmosphere, carbon dioxide was taken up by the plants, became plant material, the plants died, and those materials slowly decay in the soil, but they accumulate through time. And they accumulate lots and lots of carbon, 250 or so tons of carbon per acre of soil in a rich prairie soil. It's an immense amount of carbon. When the soil is farmed, about 40 to 60% of that carbon is released back to the air. And these degraded soils then can take that carbon back up if you plant them back with the kind of species that form that soil in the first place. So basically what we're suggesting is that by managing some of these lands that are no longer actively used in agriculture properly, by restoring them with the species that actually form the soil in the first place, you'll be able to fill that soil back up with the carbon it used to have. And doing so, it can have a huge impact because soils are this major storehouse of carbon on the Earth's surface. So we're suggesting doing this with prairie. It can also be done with forested ecosystems. And prairies, you know, had deep carbon-rich soils at the time when this area was settled. And prairie can be brought back to that. Those soils can be brought back to that status by planting prairie. And let me show you some results. This shows how much carbon dioxide, and these are in tons per hectare, divide by about 2 to get tons per acre. How much carbon dioxide in our experiment was removed from the atmosphere, became organic carbon, and ended up being stored in the organic matter in the soil. as a function of how many species were in the plots. So you see the curve that goes up fairly strongly. We had no detectable carbon stores on average for any of our single species plots, but we were storing quite a bit of carbon, 3 or so tons per hectare per year, in the high diversity plots. There's also carbon stored in the living biomass of the plants. So that's also removed from the air as the prairie grows and they develop their dense, long live root system that stores more carbon. We can ask, that's how much carbon there is accumulating in that ecosystem year by year. What effect would this have on the carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas impact of these biofuels? We can estimate how much fossil carbon dioxide is needed to plant a prairie, to mow the prairie, to bale it, to haul it off to a place to be processed into a biofuel, and so on. And that comes out to about 0.3 tons per hectare. Compared to the 4.4 total storage that we get per year, what we have is that these prairies are having a net storing of about 2 U.S. tons per acre of carbon dioxide removed from the atmosphere and stored in the soil every year per acre of land that is planted back to high diversity prairie. And that means that when you use this biomass to make a biofuel, you'll end up having less carbon dioxide in the air when you're done burning that biofuel than you had before you even made the biofuel, which means that biofuels made from this high-diversity prairie biomass are going to be carbon negative. Carbon negative actually to a very large extent, surprisingly large extent. Their production and use, because of all the carbon that's being stored in the soil, is being sequestered in the soil, ends up leading to lower and lower carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. Now, I want to say something else. Let's say it at the end. This is not a cure-all. This is not going to get rid of our whole greenhouse warming effect. We have a huge problem we're facing globally. This is sort of one slice. This done around the world might get rid of a seventh or so of the problem. So this is not the ultimate, if you will, solution, but it is a technology that is available now that can help solve the problem. There is no single solution for this problem. So here are the greenhouse gas reductions from all the different things. Compared to burning gasoline or diesel or coal to make electric, here is the magnitude of the reductions in greenhouse gases that we have by growing prairie grasses on degraded soils and using them as an energy source. They are 6 to 16 times greater than you get by growing corn ethanol or soybean biodiesel. And they both do lead to reductions. So this is this next generation of technology can lead to much, much greater reductions. I want to briefly mention one other benefit, and that is that because these are grown with low inputs of fertilizers, nitrogen, phosphorus, without irrigation, with low inputs of pesticides and so on, those chemicals don't move from the field in which the prairie biomass is grown into groundwaters and lakes, rivers, and streams and so on. And so there's a benefit of about a tenfold increase in water quality because of the decrease in the loading of those nutrients in the groundwater if you use prairie biomass, high-diversity prairie perennials to gain energy versus using corn or soybeans. Finally, I want to say that right now we do have an industry that uses corn for ethanol and is producing a lot of ethanol. I just want to suggest a slight sort of tweak on that industry which could have a huge environmental benefit. If you look at the corn produced by an acre of ground and ask how much ethanol can that produce, you can ask, well, how might we make that ethanol carbon neutral? Well, we have to have something like prairie growing, taking up carbon dioxide and sequestering in the soil. It takes the sequestration of about 3/4 of an acre of prairie on degraded soil to make up for all of the carbon dioxide released from combustion of fossil fuels to grow corn and transport it to a processing facility. The biomass produced on that 3/4 of an acre of degraded prairie has enough energy in it to run the full ethanol production facility. So if you burn that biomass, gasify it at an ethanol production facility, it will give you all the energy you need to convert that corn from an acre of land into the 400 gallons of ethanol you get out. And now, instead of having only 80 gallons of that ethanol be new energy, non-fossil energy, 150 gallons of that per acre is now fossil energy. Is now non-fossil energy. It's new energy not derived from fossil fuel because you're powering that ethanol plant with the energy in the prairie plants, not with natural gas or coal, which are the two other alternatives. So in summary, I'd like to suggest that I think there are some steps that we should be thinking about now, some steps we can start to take. They can build upon some of the major resources we have in Minnesota. We have, as I said, about 1.5 acres of land in CRP that has the potential to provide us with significant energy gains, the potential to sequester and remove carbon dioxide, with the possibility of having Minnesota produce and start marketing ethanol, which is carbon neutral, truly a carbon neutral fuel. I think a marketing approach which can be increasingly important. We have the potential in Minnesota to say in the foreseeable future, the next 3 to 5 or so years, that ethanol produced here should be carbon neutral. That would be a much better reason to be burning ethanol in our cars than just because it's a renewable fuel. We have to look at the costs and benefits, the inputs and outputs. And we can make ethanol that is much better than we have it right now by using prairie biomass. And that could be, if you will, a pathway, a step towards the next generation of, let's say, cellulosic ethanol or gasification approaches to biomass. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Tillman. And any questions? Representative Hockey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Or should I say Mr. Chairs?
It's all laughs.
Dr. Tillman, quick question for you. And I think all this is great, and I'm a big supporter of whatever we can do for cellulosic ethanol and cellulosic energy. At the DNR roundtable this year, we had, I believe it was Dr. Steve Taff, and I might have one of my doctors mixed up, but I think that was the doctor that was telling us that we're just not ready for this. We don't know enough about it. We don't know how to market it. We don't know if this is going to work. Who am I to believe? I don't know anything about science.
Okay. You should believe both of us.
You could be in the legislature.
I wasn't trying to imply that we're ready to do cellulosic ethanol now. Okay. I presented the last idea as a bridge from where we are right now, where we have corn producing ethanol and plants being powered by fossil fuel, toward what we think the way the science is advancing will be the possibility in 5 to 7 years, where we have cellulose being converted into ethanol and the undigestible parts of the plant, the lignin in the plant, and something else called hemicellulose, being used as the energy source to run those ethanol plants. So they will then gasify that biomass, use it to run their plant, to produce electric and everything else they need to run the ethanol plant. This would be sort of an intermediate step. They would be using biomass for that purpose along the way. But no, we're not yet ready to do cellulosic ethanol.
Okay, and I didn't mean, no disrespect intended. Another question, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hockey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we've already established that I know nothing about science, if you're growing a mixture of native grasses, blue stem and switchgrass and things like that, and you harvest it every year, don't you need to fertilize it? And I know you cover this a little bit, but what goes into the soil to replenish the nutrients to help it keep growing?
Clearly, one major nutrient, nitrogen, is provided by legumes, which fix the nitrogen. So our mixtures had a high abundance of the legumes, and they were very important in causing them to be so productive. The plant, when you harvest the biomass, we are suggesting harvesting it in late autumn, which has the advantage that all the birds have fledged from nests. You won't be having the wildlife impact of harvesting. And there even are good procedures that have been worked out for how do you mow a field for biomass to minimize impact on the wildlife that is there. We want to maintain the wildlife value. But also by mowing it late in the year, it's dry, which means you don't need to let it dry out as you do hay. And the plant has drawn a lot of the nutrients that were in the above-ground parts back to the roots. The above-ground part dies. It's standing there as dead biomass, has very little nutrient content. And so you don't have to replace as much as you might think. We're talking about removing from an acre of land about 3 to 5 pounds of phosphorus per acre. It's not very much. Eventually you will have to put some back in. It surprised me that in the areas of Kansas that they've been mowing this for so long that they haven't yet been putting it back in. They haven't yet seen yields go down. Clearly, in the long term, you have to replace that. It's just that these crops remove so much less nutrient because you're harvesting once the plants are dead and you're harvesting the low nutrient parts. It's a very different story than corn or soybeans. But clearly, in the long term, you will have to reach an equilibrium where you put back in what you're removing. But it'll be a low input compared to most crops.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another quick question. What happens to the carbon that gets sequestered into the ground? Does that ultimately go somewhere, or are we making coal too? in the long run?
Dr. Tillman?
That's a very good question. What happens as carbon builds up in the soil, there are always organisms that are working to decompose it. But initially the rate of addition of new carbon is greater than the rate of decomposition. As this carbon builds up, you finally reach a large enough level in the soil that the rate at which it comes in from the plants each year is balanced by the rate at which the microorganisms decompose it, and then it levels off. And it will stay at that level as long as you don't change how you treat that field. If it stays as a prairie, you'll have that level of carbon in it. It'll level off. It takes about 250 years to level off, but it'll stay at that point, as best we know, forever.
One last question, Mr. Chair, and I'm hoping to be retired by then. Is there any way, speaking as a guy that likes to walk through fields of cellulosic material in the fall, is there any practical way that we could wait and harvest this in January, say?
I could tell me.
If it weren't covered with snow, it would work. So this year it might have worked. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Tillman. Kind of following up a little bit on Representative Hoppe, I get a little worried when we look at CRP and just say, well, you know, let's harvest that. Let's harvest the millions of acres of CRP that are out there as if it's that easy. A lot of that CRP took 2 or 3 or 4 years to establish. It's been managed sporadically with fire or with periodic mowing, and you know, every time there's a farm bill debate, there's usually an effort to reduce the CRP, and the federal government just decided not to have any more whole field enrollments, that there won't be any general sign-ups for CRP because the land is needed for production. So I would just caution that I think we should try to talk about adding prairie grasses rather than taking what's already there being established, because I think we could put more ground into native grasses or legumes rather than turning conservation into a commodity. That's my concern.
Yes, I think it's a very real concern, and it was initially a major concern of my own and the people in my group. But as we've done more research on the impacts of late fall harvesting on wildlife and so on, our concern has decreased. And as I've read more about the ability of a prairie to be harvested for hay year after year after year and still maintain its biological diversity, my concerns have decreased. Whether or not it's on CRP land is a good question. I would be disappointed to see the investment we've made in CRP land be greatly decreased, because it has been has had a large environmental benefits. But I don't claim to have all the answers on what the impacts of harvesting might be. But I think if it is done, it has to be done wisely and carefully. And it probably can't have a whole field harvested in a given year. That you have to leave cover for wildlife and so on. So there'll be quite a bit of knowledge that we'll need to gain and apply to do it wisely. But I think it could be done wisely. I also think that there are other lands that could be producing biofuel for us that are currently in agriculture or used in other ways that we should be looking at other than just CRP. I agree with you on that point wholeheartedly.
Thank you, Dr. Tillman. Any other questions at all? Yes, I have one. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Tillman, on the second page of the slide, you have the potential of food-based biofuels if we had put everything we could into corn ethanol, for example. How would that... Do you have another column for what happens if we put in or cultivate a certain amount of acres in biofuels?
I've had such slides. I didn't show it. I mean, it's a hard point to ask what I might suggest. I mean, we could say we put all of our corn into biofuels, but I actually think we need to have food to eat. So I guess my concern about this issue, and I hope it's one that you, I'm sure you understand it, is trying to find this balance between a variety of societal needs. That's what you do all the time. We are trying to find balance. There are all these needs of society. You have to find some way to balance them. And I'm very concerned about food production, not just here, but around the world and where we're heading that way, because these, we now have global markets for food and energy. And I'm trying to think of ways that we can use our land resources to meet many of these needs. And so I offered CRP land as sort of one easily identified category of land, the quantity that we know, that could be converted. And CRP land converted into biofuels this way would give us about what our corn would be giving us right now, about the same kind of energy gain. It's about the same. It's close. I don't remember the exact number, but it's around there.
Mr. Chair, the reason I pose a question is I think we're all attracted to this idea of having a less energy-intensive biofuel, but we also want to be realistic about how we're going to get there and what the total scope of it is, because I think it were, Dr. Tillman, you showed us the wedges, was it?
Yes, I did.
On the house floor? That actually helped make the issue very fuel achievable anyway. That there are some areas in conservation and new fuels and so on, and that was helpful. But I look forward to having a discussion over the next, for the whole session, to figure out how this is all going to work and who's going to choose to do this and have it on their property. It's a whole range of issues that will be challenging to think through. But thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Any other questions? I did have a question. As far as preparing for the possibility of the cellulosic ethanol, we obviously need some time to ramp up and generate the biomass material. The prairie grass is necessary, and it does take some time to get these grasses going, and we need to prepare a seed bank as well. And I was wondering if you have any suggestions as far as incentives to get such a process underway. It seems to me that, and maybe you can comment about the cap and trade systems, if you've looked at those at all, if they've been successful in creating kind of an incentive by creating a market for carbon credits and resulting in more prairie grasses being planted, and that would possibly get the biomass material in the ground necessary for when the cellulosic energy is ready to go.
Mr. Chair, my first comment is you are the professionals at converting these ideas into policy, but I'll share my thoughts with you. A major market force that could really encourage this to happen would be to have there be a market demand for biomass as an energy source. I've told you the benefits that come from the prairie biomass, all of the energy benefits, the environmental benefits. Right now there's no market force that encourages that. Something as simple as mandating that a certain proportion, let's say ethanol, be a certain proportion between what it is right now, which is a 14% reduction in greenhouse gases, and being totally carbon neutral, and having that sort of ramp toward being carbon neutral 4 or 5 or 6 years in the future, that could have a huge impact on the demand for biofuels that are produced in a way that sequesters carbon. If the demand is there, then there will be an incentive for energy producers to buy it, and therefore an incentive for farmers to produce it. I've had well over 100 emails from farmers throughout the state who asked me, what should they plant? Do they want to be producing a biofuel that's more environmentally friendly? And I admire them for their goals and so on. My statement right now is I can't tell you to plant anything until there's a market for it. I just can't lead somebody on that path unless we know there'll be some way for that biomass to be used. I think in the short term, we have to have some kind of a grant program to get this started. We have to have some way that a farmer who wants to do this can afford the initial investment. At the same time, have a way that we are creating a demand for it. And I would think that we demand that our gasoline be 10% ethanol, which is a renewable fuel, as we know. And we know we can make ethanol better than we make it right now by using prairie biomass or other biomass as a way to power the plants. So why don't we move in that direction and say that we're going to be insisting that more and more of the ethanol be made in a way which gives us greater net energy gain and greater greenhouse gas benefits, and that'll instantly create a market for this kind of biomass.
Thank you, Dr. Tillman. Any other questions at all? Seeing no other questions, thank you for joining us. We'll let you catch your plane. Next, we have Dr. Ed Nader. Let's step forward and state your name for the record, please, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My name is Edward Nader. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota. Chairman Hilty, Chairman Eakin, representatives, and citizens, thank you for inviting me here to speak. And give me a moment. I'll get this back set up for my own presentation. Shouldn't take too long here. Excuse me. Okay. I wish to speak a little bit about the potential for carbon sequestration in Minnesota. And I worked in this with a number of people. The presentation I give represents both myself and a graduate student, Megan Lennon. And then there's going to be an economic analysis portion of it that's from Stephen Pulaski and Yang Liu in the Department of Applied Economics, College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences. We are part of a Minnesota initiative on carbon sequestration that was funded by a number of people, including IRI and Xcel Energy, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, et cetera, a number of people here. The steering committee includes a number of people from the University of Minnesota, people from state agencies, NGOs, and industry. So the first part of this talk, I'll talk about the biophysical aspects of carbon sequestration. And in particular, I'm a soil scientist, so I'll spend a little more time probably on the soil than some of the other things. But most of you have seen this particular graph. It's a graph of atmospheric carbon dioxide as measured at Mauna Loa in Hawaii because it happens to have a very open and free background. It's not impacted by cities and so forth. And over the period of observation from the late 50s until now, it has steadily increased through that time frame. It's gone from about 310 parts per million to almost 380 and is predicted to increase for some period of time. The majority of this increase is due in large part to industry and the burning of fossil fuels. There are other aspects that are involved in this, land use changes, in particular cutting of forests and the tilling of the prairies, but the major source, the overwhelming source, is emissions. So one of the questions we ask is, can land use change play a role in solving this problem, and if so, how? And that's through the process we call terrestrial carbon sequestration, where atmospheric carbon dioxide is converted to biomass by plants. It's a natural thing that they do. And then from there it is converted to some type of stable form. It might be wood products, it could be soil organic carbon, or it could be something else, peatlands, for example, organic soils. I want to call your attention in particular to the areas here highlighted in red. These are particularly germane to Minnesota. This is the terrestrial accounting of carbon in tons per hectare. And there, if you'll notice that the forests have significant quantity in the biomass. The boreal forest has quite a bit in the soil, but that's mainly in the wetlands. And then the temperate grasslands have significant soil-borne carbon, and wetlands are even higher than that, based in part on the fact that it doesn't decompose very readily. These are the areas that we would want to target if we were going to try to use terrestrial processes to sequester carbon from the atmosphere. So the objectives of this study, which was a literature review of all the current literature, and there's quite a bit out there, was to develop a carbon market in Minnesota that is dependent on having accurate verifiable carbon sequestration practices. We don't want to trade real carbon going up a smokestack for carbon that is supposedly being put in the ground or into biomass that in fact is not there. That's a license to pollute. So for this potential, we wanted to determine what are the rates for each of these potential practices, how much carbon is pulled out of the atmosphere per year and put into some form of stable biomass, what are the uncertainties around those, how accurate are they, and how much confidence do we have in the data and what is estimated from that data. So we set up some selection criteria for these particular practices. One of those is that they must be relevant to Minnesota. This is a Minnesota study. It has to be something acceptable to landholders. There has to be sufficient aerial extent that we're going to impact carbon significantly. Something that occurs on a few acres is not going to be meaningful in the long run. And we have to have data present in the literature to be able to analyze it. Conducting these studies is a long-term process and very expensive. We didn't have the time for that in this particular analysis. So the particular land management practices we were considering and we proposed that might sequester carbon include forestation, whether it's putting lands that are not currently in forest into forest growth or reforestation, the development of grasslands and prairies, wetland restoration, you saw the massive quantities in wetlands, conservation tillage, which has been proposed in the literature, and a lot of people assume that will have a strong impact, and the use of cover crops as a way of pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. We're going to talk for just a minute here about each of these little areas, and then we'll go back into the actual results from the literature survey. So the first one is forest biomass. We're talking about a direct conversion of CO2 to biomass by the trees themselves. And then following that, there's a period of sequestration, which depends on the duration of the standing biomass plus the life of the products. If the products are paper products, they have a fairly short lifespan. If they're wood used for building or furniture or something like that, then there's a longer lifespan associated with that. One thing about these are easily verified. Foresters have measured the rate of tree growth for many years. Forest soils are more difficult to look at because they can be quite variable. The second area is soil organic carbon. The quantities present, as David stated, are quite large, and they are a steady state between the rates of addition and the decomposition. In many respects, I view the steady state as if it were a large bucket with a tap coming into it and a hole in the side. If you turn on the tap, the water level raises up to some point above the hole, and then the water flow out the hole starts to catch up with the inflow, and you reach a point where you're holding steady at a steady level in the bucket. If you increase the rate of flow, you rise above that, but pretty soon the pressure is high enough from that added water that you get more of a flow coming out, and so you reach a new steady state. Likewise, you can increase it by decreasing the size of the hole. This is what we're trying to look at in this process. It's difficult to verify changes in soils due to the fact that we have small changes added to very high initial quantities that are also quite variable. So simple sampling of soils the year after you grow something will not tell you much. It takes longer term studies than that, and that's one of the problems out there in the literature. Likewise, these additions represent a small change to a large quantity. With respect to these, the inputs from plant growth are fairly easy to measure. We know we can fairly accurately determine what the above-ground and below-ground biomass inputs are. Rates of decomposition are much more variable and difficult to quantify. They depend on things like the aeration rate, the moisture, the nitrogen-to-carbon ratio, and a variety of other things. We do know the rates of decline as this new steady state is approached, but often it's many years out to move from one steady state to another, often hundreds of years. Finally, we're seeking practices that produce these higher steady states by either increasing the inputs, decreasing the decomposition rates, or both. And I think the prairie is an example of one that does both of those. So we move to these specific practices to discuss them and to look at them. One of those is afforestation and reforestation. A second one is conversion to grassland. restoration of wetlands, reduced tillage, and the use of cover crops in a corn-soybean rotation. And part of what we're trying to do in this is look at changes, especially from one set of land uses to another. To qualify for Kyoto-type protocols, you have to make a change. You cannot keep doing the same thing you're doing to get enrolled for credits. So the first one that I'll talk about is afforestation and reforestation. Generally, this is conversion of land not currently in forest to a forested situation. And this can be abandoned farmland, it can be cut-over lands, it can be something like that. The above-ground biomass accumulation is by far the dominant part of this. The soil carbon is of a lesser importance and is also more variable. It can increase, decrease, or stay the same over the time frame we're talking about here. The duration of sequestration is dependent on the life of the tree plus the life of secondary products that come from that. In general, when we look at Minnesota forest growth, we have good numbers for this. This is something foresters have measured for a long time. How fast do trees grow? How much productivity do we get? And the forest growth can add about 300 grams of carbon per meter square per year to pulling it from the atmosphere to the standing biomass. In conversion to the terms David was talking about, that's about 3 metric tons per hectare per year, or a little over around a ton and a half of English tons per acre. Hybrid poplar is one of the plants that people have suggested we utilize for this because it's faster growing. In some places it grows a lot faster. It's not that much faster here. We show values here around 350 grams of carbon per meter square per year. But these are fairly easily verified. Second process we looked at and studied was the conversion of row crop agriculture or other lands to grasslands and prairies. And in particular, we looked at a number of situations like CRP lands, buffer strip grasslands along streams, pasture, and things like that. Pastures are a little difficult to determine because there are a wide array of grazing processes out there, a number of management practices that make it more difficult to ascertain exactly what's going on in a specific area. But in general, we're seeking to enhance soil carbon over a long periods of time. The above-ground biomass in a prairie is typically only about 40% of the total biomass grown. About 60% of that is underground. Of that 60%, a third of that turns over every year, so you're having almost 20% of the total annual growth of the crop converting into soil organic matter per year. There's a decomposition rate on that, but it's a significant input over periods of time. This is how the prairies have built up these large and very dark horizons over time. In addition, there are some significant additional ecological services that can come from these grasslands, including erosion reduction, improvements in water quality due to sediment losses and pickup of nutrients, stabilization of banks, and increases in wildlife habitat and biodiversity. The estimates that we came up with for most of the processes we're talking about are sequestration rates ranging from about 25 to 100 grams of carbon per meter squared per year. This is in agricultural lands that are degraded, not in the more marginal lands that Dr. Tillman has been talking about. But these rates could be higher than this depending upon the situation we're in. And these rates have been verified for about 5 to 10 years. They seem fairly accurate. So we're quite happy with those. Wetlands and peatlands are another major sink of carbon in the world. Worldwide, peatlands represent only about 3% of the terrestrial surface, of the whole land surface, but they represent about 33% of the soil carbon pool, which is a massive quantity. It's almost equal to the amount in the atmosphere itself. And this is particularly important in Minnesota, where we have 7 million acres of peatlands. And the protection of those peatlands to prevent them from degrading due to global climate change, drainage, or things like that is quite important. There's a significant amount of carbon there. Burning and loss of those could greatly impact the atmospheric carbon loads. The nice part about peatlands is that the decomposition rates on the organic carbon in the soil are quite low. They have reducing conditions, and so the organic matter simply does not decompose very rapidly because the microbes that grow there do not grow very rapidly. And so you can continually accrete carbon on top of it over time frames. Many of these are 10 to 20 feet thick and contain the carbon that's accumulated for 4 to 5,000 years. There's limited data available on natural wetlands. Most of that is difficult to ascertain because the changes that occur over time are small compared to the huge masses of carbon that are present there. There have been some studies using micrometeorological methods, which actually measure directly the flux of CO2 from the atmosphere to the land surface. And those studies have given us rates on the order of 60 to 80 grams of carbon per meter squared per year, which is a significant total going in. That's quite variable, however, depending upon the season, the warmth of the ground, the water table, and a variety of things like that. Restored wetlands, ones which have been drained and then have been refilled and allowed to revegetate, show very significant rates of around 300 grams of carbon per meter squared per year. This one is the one that you've probably heard the most about, the use of reduced tillage as a means of sequestering carbon. There's an emphasis here on increasing soil carbon stores. In conventional tillage, we overturn the upper 6 to 12 inches of the soil, enhancing aeration quite a bit. It also buries the surface litter. Since we know that aeration enhances microbial activity, it presumably also enhances organic matter decomposition, causing a net decrease in soil carbon. This is part of the reason our agricultural soils have less carbon than the prairie soils they came from. The other part is lower additions. There's less addition from corn and beans than there is from prairie grasses. Reduced tillage does not overturn the soil and therefore probably does not cause as much organic matter decomposition because there's less aeration. The presumption is then the net effect would be more carbon in the soil under reduced tillage. There are numerous studies of this process out there. Most of these are based on shallow soil sampling on the order of 10 centimeters to 30 centimeters, but most of them in the 10 to 20 centimeter range. And these give, in side-by-side comparisons, they tend to show that no-till gives a sequestration rate of 22 to 85 grams of carbon per meter squared per year. The Chicago Climate Exchange is now paying payments for no-till farming as a means of sequestering carbon. Recent studies, and there are several of these coming, there seems to be an increasing knowledge base on this that are based on deeper soil sampling or on micromet methods, typically show no difference between reduced and conventional tillage methods. Since no-till does not bury the residue, one would expect higher concentrations of carbon on the surface where the residue is added. Because conventional tillage does incorporate and bury residue, one would expect to see higher concentrations at depth. If your soil sampling is sufficiently shallow that you're only sampling the very surface, you aren't going to see the buried carbon. And this has been observed if we look at some deep cores. If you look at the three lines above me, they represent going from the soil surface down to a depth of 45 centimeters. There is a pink one, a blue one, and a yellow one. I hope you can make those out. The pink one, if you look at it, it shows the most carbon going the furthest to the right, about 20 megagrams of carbon per hectare at the very surface. But as you go down, you can see that it starts to decrease fairly rapidly as you go down in the soil. If you look at the yellow one, which is a moldboard plow, you can see that it's lower at the surface, but it increases at depth where the organic materials are buried. This makes perfect sense if you think about how tillage works. What the real total is the total area under those curves, the amount that's to the left of those curves from top to bottom, and there is no difference between those curves. There's a difference in where the distribution is, whether it's at the surface or whether it's at depth, but there's no difference in the total amount of carbon. Based on those kinds of studies and on micrometeorological studies, looking at the direct measure of the flux of the CO2 from the atmosphere to the surface, we say, contrary to a large body of existing literature, there is an increasing awareness that reduced tillage does not sequester carbon, and that basing a carbon trading scheme on no-till is probably fallacious. You are probably trading real smokestack carbon for pie-in-the-sky carbon, or pie-in-the-ground carbon, if you will. So our estimates and the measures that we have seen out there of careful, rigorous scientific measurements show that the corn and soybean systems are essentially carbon neutral, and that doesn't matter whether no-till or conventional tillage. Cover crops are another way of potentially sequestering more carbon. They're grown between harvest of one crop and planting of the next crop to protect the soil from erosion, provide green manure for the next crop, etc. If you incorporate a fast-growing cover crop in the corn-soybean rotation, you have the potential for it to pull more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere as it's growing. If it does not decompose rapidly, it will retain some of that in the soil. This is an example of a rye, winter rye cover crop. There's current studies going on in Rosemont, California, looking at the potential of these. These are fairly new studies, but the cover crops grown after harvest of one crop protect the soil from erosion, provide green manure for the following. I'm going the wrong way here. Let me try that again. That looks better. Okay, sorry about that. Limited data that we have on these studies suggests that a winter rye cover crop can sequester 200 to 300 grams of carbon per meter squared per year, which is equivalent to the growth of a mature Douglas fir forest. Significant amounts of carbon are pulled out of the atmosphere. This does this with while leaving working lands working, while still allowing for the growth of the corn and soybean crops. But it depends on what you're using for a cover crop. Oats had similar rates of biomass accumulation, but decomposed so rapidly that within a year, virtually all of it was gone. There was no net carbon gain. So conclusions of this part of the study of this critical review suggest that afforestation, agroforestry, wetland restoration, conversion of croplands to grasslands, and the use of winter rye cover crops all have the potential to sequester carbon, and we do not support the idea that reduced tillage can sequester significant quantities of carbon, contrary to the results of many. As Representative Hoppe said earlier, he's testified that he is not a scientist. I'd like to go on the record myself that I am not an economist. So I will present this data, but please remember all the shortcomings in the presentation are mine. Stephen Pulaski is an economist and a fine one at that. So I'm going to go through this very quickly and simply talk about the results that he has. The research objectives of this part, the aim of this is to estimate the cost of achieving various levels of terrestrial carbon sequestration in Minnesota. And the relevance for policy on this is that voluntary sequestration programs are going to require payments to landowners for sequestration and also to try and determine for a given price how much carbon is likely to be sequestered. Objectives of this derive a statewide supply curve, and in particular the analysis is on agricultural lands, not on forest or peatlands. The supply curve is derived by changing to the alternate land use in order from the lowest cost to the highest cost of carbon sequestered. So whatever you get that gives you the most for the least money is going to be the first practice. An analysis tends to show which alternatives are likely the best. They study the same practices based upon our results that we did. And they give some values in here for carbon sequestration rates for the alternatives. And with the one difference they show is that what happens if you harvest agroforestry for an energy crop or something else in here. In trying to estimate the costs of this, they use the bottom-up engineering approach, assume that landowners will automatically try to maximize their profits. They will switch to alternative practices if there's an expected higher profit in that. and they'll solve for the minimum carbon credit payment that will get the landowner to switch. There are costs to this. One is the opportunity cost of agricultural land, what you could have made if you were using it for something else, the cost of establishing and maintaining these practices, and subtracting off the benefits of alternative practices, what you might lose. So broke it down by the agricultural regions of the state and came up with, from those regions, average rental rates for agricultural land in those regions to determine what the opportunity costs are from that. Went from there to develop the components of the cost, which are the establishment costs and the maintenance costs, the benefits of the alternative practices for agroforestry. You generate a value from periodic harvest. They did not look at the environmental co-benefits, although there are certainly some out there. They looked at this from a purely economic analysis. And then looked at the summary of costs and benefits for these practices. And the monetary benefits for all of them are zero, except in agroforestry, where there's an assumption that they are selling off timber or pulp at some frequency. Looked at the establishment costs for all of these, and is there a land cost associated with them? That is true for all of those except for the use of cover crops, because you are still growing the corn soybean rotation among those. From that, they developed a supply curve of carbon sequestration in Minnesota, which shows, starting on the left, for a certain payment, how much carbon is going to be sequestered. And as you increase that payment from $0 to $50 to $100 per metric ton of carbon, how much carbon is going to be sequestered. And you can, from looking at this, you can tell that until you get up to about $50 per metric ton of carbon, you are looking at fairly low amounts of carbon sequestered here. Supply curve on this is the total capacity for carbon sequestration on these lands on the order of 20 megatons per million megatons per year. And the cost of obtaining this, a small portion of a win-win solution for the direct value, actually exceeds the value of the current land use. For most of this, the sequestration cost would run from $50 to $135 per metric ton. So current carbon market prices for comparison on the European market is 808.5 euros, or $10.90 per metric ton of CO2, which is about $40 per metric ton of carbon. The Chicago Climate Exchange is about $15 per metric ton of carbon. And the prices are quite volatile. They both have moved up and down significantly from that time frame. But at the current prices, we would not see a significant amount of carbon sequestration here. There are a number of notes that he provides on things that you should caution. I will leave those for you to read, but just to move on and say thank you for allowing me the time to present here. I would be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Dr. Nader and Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Nader, I have a confession to make. Not only am I not a scientist, I'm not an economist either. I do have one question for you, and if you can't answer this, I'm just curious. With all the carbon sequestration that we do, if we do all of this in Minnesota, does that begin to or more than offset what's going on in countries like China where they're not doing this?
No, it does not totally offset it. In fact, if we do all of these practices, we will not completely offset it. We will reduce the total rate of increase of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. It will take a number of practices to reduce that, including alternative fuels, reduction in total energy use, and a number of things like that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Those would be the wedges that Dr. Tillman spoke
of. That's correct.
Any other questions? Representative Ogenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question as a concern about the hybrid poplar.
Yes.
We've had beekeepers complain immensely about the chemicals that are used on hybrid poplar and what that does to their bees. That's one issue, but the issue I'm more concerned about, actually, is what those chemicals would be doing to our native pollinators, because it's our native pollinators that actually pollinate the prairie that we want to have. And as far as I know, when I've asked the Department of Ag if they've done studies on native pollinators, they haven't. Is that something that's being done at the U?
Dr. Nader.
Thank you for the question. I'm afraid I do not know the answer to that, but I could certainly find out from an entomology department and get back to you on that if you would like.
But I would appreciate that, because it does seem we're doing things that might be conflicting with one another.
Yes, quite possibly. These are complex problems.
Mm-hmm. Representative Brainard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering about correlating what you're saying about carbon sequestration with what Dr. Tillman was saying about creating a market for biomass and prairie lands. And the economic study here doesn't seem, and maybe I'm missing something because there's a lot going on quickly, but seem to take into account the factor of creating a market in the fuel arena for the biomass. You talk about payments for carbon sequestration, but the profit element from the product ought to be increasing if we're creating a market through such factors as an energy standard. So is that ignored in this study, or am I making, do you get my question?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Thank you for that question. The scope of this study was to look at the potential for developing a carbon market in Minnesota. And at the time we started this study, we did not have access to Dr. Tillman's results or the conclusions of his study. But we were concerned mainly with looking at what it would take to get people to switch over to doing this strictly from a sequestration standpoint. Obviously, if there's a profit to be made from the biomass that's grown on the above ground part of the plant as well, that will only enhance the potential for changeover to that. And landowners typically look at all of the aspects that they have out in front of them and try and choose the best one. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Representative Hilty.
Dr. Nader, going back to your comments about till versus no-till and the conclusion that no-till did not have any advantage in carbon sequestration, but the impression that I have had, or I believe it's correct, that one of the advantages in no-till is simply that you're using a lot less fossil fuel in that practice to begin with. Is that something that you considered in the conclusions that you drew about the advantage, or is this purely focused on what the plants are capable of sequestering or not?
Thank you, Dr. Nader. We did not specifically include those aspects in the analysis. That's another one of the environmental co-benefits that we did not talk about. We recognize them, and we understand there are a number of advantages to no-till besides the energy. There are also advantages in leaving residue on the surface, reduction of erosion, and so forth. But again, this analysis strictly focused on getting carbon out of the atmosphere into the ground.
Thank you.
Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I came in a little late, but is biomass different in that if you burn woody crops, poplar trees, regular trees, corn stalks, is there some of those that you would say aren't then good biomass renewable energy projects or products to produce energy from, but prairie grass that's stable in the ground and you don't plant it every year is a better biomass product, or I'll ask that question.
Dr. Nader.
Thank you. I believe there are some advantages to each of the fuels that you talked about. The wooded products in particular are denser and easier to transport. You get significantly more mass moving at a time with less bulk. But one of the advantages of the prairie biomass project that Dr. Tillman talked about is that even though you get a significant amount of above-ground biomass that you can burn and convert to energy or utilize in some other fashion to convert to energy, you also get about 60% of the total biomass is actually below ground and adds to the carbon in the soil and enhances sequestration, thereby reducing the total amount of carbon in the atmosphere.
So, follow up. What was the number on corn stalks or a perennial or an annual crop? If you use corn stalks to burn, for instance, what would the net carbon gain be because you plow up the roots or the no-till roots? Follow what I'm saying?
Dr. Nader.
Yes, I think I do. In general, with the current system we have for growing corn in this country, with the stalks being returned to the soil by tillage or no-till operations, we find that the total carbon value is about neutral, that the amount of carbon released to the atmosphere is about the same over the course of a year as the plant takes up. And part of that is released through the grain that's harvested, and the rest of it is released through decomposition of those biomass materials. Removing the stover and utilizing that for a fuel would in fact decrease the amount of organic inputs to the soil and probably would over time slowly decrease the amount of carbon in the soil. So the amount of roots on an annual crop like corn compared to the above ground biomass is significantly smaller than 60%. I don't know what that actual figure is, but I would guess more like 30%.
So Last question. So by burning corn stalks or wheat straw or even poplar trees, then would you say we're releasing more carbon than if you just let those plants fall on the ground and decay and die naturally? Am I concluding that right?
Yes, I think that's true to some extent. You have a certain biomass that you enhance in the soil by incorporating the corn stover and the roots to it. And if that's not incorporated, you're reducing your total inputs. The same would be true for a burning of any biomass. You're releasing it back to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. So the harvest would release it. On the other hand, it's not a fossil fuel. So you are returning carbon that you pulled out of the atmosphere. And this is where we start to get into the discussions about what is carbon neutrality and how neutral are specific fuels. Are they positive, negative, or neutral?
I see.
Thanks.
Any further questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Dr. Nader. And we have one other person who's going to be testifying with us today, Ms. Cheryl Miller, who's the project coordinator for the Minnesota Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative. If you could just state your name for the record, please, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Representative Deacon. My name is Cheryl Miller, and I'm the project coordinator of the Minnesota Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative that Dr. Nader just talked about. And I'm going to talk to you today about institutional or policy discussions and studies that we had with this project, in addition to the biological and economic studies. We also looked at what were some of the different institutions' markets. We started great interest in that. But then what are some of the other institutional arrangements, policies, and programs that are going on around the country and how we might apply them here? This study was done by myself and Dr. Dean Current with the Center for Integrated Natural Resource Management and Agricultural Management at the University, who was not able to be here today. The policy questions that we were generally focused on are what are the different options out there? Emissions trading or markets, one of them, but there's many other different tools that we could look at, and what are some of those things? What are other states and countries doing along these lines to increase carbon sequestration, and what would be some important considerations here in Minnesota related to all that? The early drivers, of course, are the big international treaties from the 1990s, the Rio 15 years ago and Kyoto 10 years ago, that really recognized and kind of highlighted for the first time the importance of these terrestrial sinks or reservoirs that hold so much carbon in ecosystems. And the International Panel on Climate Change, that scientific body that advises governments on the science of climate change, projected that if we ramped up current practices of all kinds, soil management, forestry practices, etc., that we could potentially offset between 10 and 20% of emissions, fossil fuel emissions, in the next 50 years. They believe that that was particularly important because these programs are already used. There are many practices that farmers and foresters have used for generations. So if they could be ramped up quickly, they could really slow the rate of climate change and also reduce its adverse effects. I'm going to skip that one and just say that many different states are trying now to apply some of the ideas or developing different programs related to terrestrial carbon sequestration. And this is a list, and I don't even think I've got all of the states, because Alaska as well is also developing some forestry programs. These are states that over the past decade have started either single programs or very multifaceted programs to increase or protect and enhance terrestrial sinks. They include agricultural states that are there on the left, and then a lot of demonstrations or big projects, reforestation projects in the southeast, a lot of other kinds of forestry projects in the northern states where there's more forests, and a new emissions trading program in the northeast states, the so-called REGI, or Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative states. So I'm going to run through some of these different approaches or policy tools that different states are using to kind of go beyond emissions trading, but to look at what are all the different tools that could be considered. And the first one is sequestration on public land. 25% of the land in this state, largely forested land, but those peatlands and, you know, many other different kinds of lands are within the public domain. They're permanently protected, they're managed by expert, highly trained people, and they could be great stores or a great kind of strategy for increasing the amount of carbon stored if we manage those ecosystems better for carbon. I think in the interest of time, I will not go through the different examples that I put here, but will just tell you that California recently announced that they're going to reforest 500,000 acres of land in the state, about half of it private land, half of it public land, setting, you know, very large targets for over the next 20 years, sequestering what they expect would offset about 35 million metric tons of carbon a year. So major reforestation effort to try to reduce emissions. BMPs on public land, on private lands. Obviously, much more of the land is owned by private individuals, and BMPs, or financial and technical assistance to use certain practices, are very widely used already, very popular programs, and could be applied or ramped up here as well. The advantages are they're popular. There's an existing infrastructure of soil and water conservation districts that could help with this. And there has been in the past some research that they are more expensive to pay for practices by the acre rather than actual tons sequestered. But more recent literature is a little uncertain on that, and I don't know if I would really conclude at this point which is the more expensive way to do it. The one consideration is that on private land there always is the permanence problem, how long you're going to contract a farmer to use certain practices that are sequestering carbon, and you know that's a major issue in trying to figure out how to sequester carbon for long periods of time. Regulations or standards is another way to reduce the degradation or the loss of terrestrial sinks, whether that's a wetland or whether that's a forest or what have you. Forestry standards, certification programs are widely used in this country, and they're being now applied to different kinds of landscapes that could be used as a way to reduce the reduction, say, for instance, of deforestation in urban developments, have a no net loss on trees in an urban development, for instance. There is always that landowner resistance to regulatory programs, and they can have some expense, but they're another one of those tools for consideration. Emissions offset programs are the ones that most people have been interested in. They are part of the Kyoto Treaty, which allowed that, or first kind of put on the kind of public stage, the idea that you could cap emissions and then have projects done elsewhere and be able to use the credits generated by those other projects to offset the emissions under the cap. And those projects or those offsets could be anything from energy efficiency, renewable energy, many different practices, and in some cases terrestrial sequestration, or that has been the great interest and the great attention that these have gotten. Huge advantage in that there's private finance would then help do these practices, contribute to paying for these practices, and a lot of the analyses of offset markets after the Kyoto was passed was that it would greatly reduce and speed up the cost of compliance with emissions targets. The disadvantages are that there are very, very high information needs, particularly with terrestrial sequestration. This is very much an emerging science. There are lots of questions about exactly how forest dynamics work now in terms of sequestering carbon. Soils, obviously, as Dr. Nader has said. And a lot of those uncertainties have made it difficult to include many different kinds of sequestration practices in emissions trading programs. In fact, currently, under Kyoto, you can only use afforestation, which is new forest on unforested land, or reforestation are the only two allowable activities to offset emissions. In the REGI states, only afforestation. So it's very limited. Sequestration is being used right now in regulatory programs until the science develops better, until the whole measurement, monitoring, verification, a transparent system for really seeing is the carbon that we put in the ground still in the ground, you know, those kinds of issues. So it is generally been proceeding, but at a very slow pace in terms of being a really big part of the regulatory market. I will point out, though, in Illinois and many places are using the Chicago Climate Exchange, a voluntary market, and using terrestrial sequestration practices there among many companies that don't have any regulatory responsibilities. Obviously, in this country, no one does. There they allow carbon sequestration or terrestrial sequestration, multiple practices, including conservation tillage to be used. So that's kind of a major concern for developing programs is what, or developing sequestration projects, is what is actually allowed as a offset that can be used by these different programs that are developing around the country. There's some of the questions about emissions trading. Another one of the sets of issues just has to do with a private market for this, and a belief that a private deal between an emitter and an offset producer is suspect in some people's minds. And a variation on that is carbon banks or trusts, and some states, including the state of Oregon, have actually one of the pioneers in this country on how the state would play a mediating role between a emitter who needs to offset emissions and using whatever sets of public objectives or priorities to decide what kinds of projects could be funded with a state carbon fund or trust. The state of Oregon, as I said, has been using this for a while and have funded all kinds of projects, you know, across the range of energy projects and some wonderful terrestrial sequestration projects. The Deschutes River reforestation is a very prized salmon fishery that they're able to offset the emissions from new energy plants by reforesting this river valley, and it has many, many benefits, in part because of that role of the state in helping select projects. Just a word about projects. All of this is, as I say, very emerging science and emerging institutions and markets and how people contract and what's equitable and who gets what and how long it lasts. And the importance of demonstration projects is really important to emphasize. There's many things that need to be better understood, and if we can get projects on the ground, that would be extremely helpful to us and obviously to policymakers who will be trying to figure out what to do in the future. The Lower Mississippi Alluvial Valley, that's an enormous Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arkansas, those states, for 20 years have been trying to make headway on restoring millions of acres of bottomland hardwoods for all kinds of purposes, migratory birds, reducing flooding, water quality, endangered species habitat, many, many, many reasons. And the new potential for offsetting emissions, selling credits for carbon sequestration has brought in lots of NGOs and private utilities that are helping do that reforestry. So it's a wonderful project to watch over time and see how's it working, what didn't work, was it done correctly, what can we do better in the future. It'd be great to see an Upper Mississippi Alluvial Valley project up here that would, you know, maybe take some of the lessons that we learned down there and try to do it a little bit better this time. The emerging approaches for terrestrial carbon, like I'm sure that you've been in many of these meetings where people have really emphasized that climate change is something that's really, the solutions are very broad, that we haven't a single solution, and it's certainly the case with terrestrial sequestration as well. If we're not getting very large benefits from conservation tillage, there are many, many other practices that can be used to improve that, and that should be looked at. That is clearly forestry practices, not only afforestation, reforestation, but thinning trees for both the productivity of the forest, for forest fire prevention, for biomass fuels. There are basically the message that comes out of reading a lot about where terrestrial carbon policy is going is you should combine it with other great wins. What are some other environmental and social economic advantages of doing these practices and combine them? Biofuels being a really important place to both sequester carbon and develop crops. Also, a whole range of forestry programs that could really increase the forest and the productivity of the forest, and also be inclusive, including carbon sequestration. We have a few recommendations I'd like to conclude with. These are recommendations by our steering committee, and you saw briefly a rundown of the state agencies that were involved in developing this project and help in making these recommendations, which are kind of recommendations to the world. These would be great things to happen, we think. We think we need a better understanding of the state's carbon resources. We know we have a very varied and large natural resource base, agricultural base, but we don't have any really good data, quantifiable data about where the big opportunities and where the big risks lie in terms of carbon sinks, terrestrial carbon sinks, and think that a better assessment of that would really help guide policymakers in the future about where to put efforts. Number two, we think that the win-win-win approach is what everyone seems to agree is the way to do this, particularly as the science develops and markets develop, I could say, as well. And so putting together both technical and stakeholder groups to really look at this and to bring in lots of different perspectives and expertises would be a very good approach to developing a state program. Many landowners and land managers just said, give us the tools. We want better tools to understand what it is we're doing. So having some kind of a study go forward through our initiative or however, we would like to just continue to develop the infrastructure for programs, both for landowners and decision makers and kind of various the whole infrastructure that needs to be created for these kinds of programs. And four is the research is unquestionably one of the most important things that we recognize is there's many more gaps in our knowledge than there are things understood. So figuring out a way that we can fund through various channels pretty long-term research and monitoring of forests, agricultural lands, wetlands, peatlands, and really be able to better understand how they're sequestering carbon, how they might be changing as the climate changes, what we can do practice-wise that could help that, etc. Current efforts is we are reaching out to lots of different organizations to think about pilot projects or demonstration projects and have a number of different things that we're starting to kind of get together and talk about. A lot of outreach and education. I've been talking to people all over the state in the last few months and will be for the foreseeable future and, of course, presentations to lawmakers like yourselves to start informing you about these issues. Thanks very much. And there's our website where the papers that Dr. Nader and Dr. Pulaski and myself have produced are there, as well as a lot of slide presentations by experts that we brought to campus, et cetera. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Are there any questions for Ms. Miller? Representative Breinhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if your website contains information on evaluations on any of the state programs you've mentioned or listed here.
Representative, no, I'm sorry. It does not yet, and that is clearly another very important thing that we need to do. The whole idea of leveraging existing programs, and I neglected to say, for instance, Minnesota Relief Program is a program that we've had in the state. It's really one of the first community forestry projects aimed at community forests, energy efficiency, and mentioned terrestrial carbon sequestration. But funds have not been available to quantify the results in terms of carbon sequestration under that program. It would be excellent to look at that and to see how that could really be used. But all of the other programs, I thanks for bringing that up. It's a very important next step.
Any other questions or comments? Representative Hilty.
Ms. Miller, I hope you're the right person to ask this question. It comes up again and again, and I was wondering I have attempted to understand it. I'm not sure that I have gotten very far, but I think probably everyone on the committee would appreciate something of an explanation of the rationale and the workings of the Chicago Climate Exchange.
Ms. Miller.
Representative Hilty, I am not the person to ask that question. I don't know what to say other than it has provided a very important first step. The companies that have volunteered to get involved in that program, to start seeing what an emissions trading program, a cap and trade program might look like, it's been a very educational process, and I really salute them for doing that. Now a whole lot of other things are starting to happen, and that is equally interesting. Emissions trading programs being developed by the REGI states will be very interesting to watch. In a way, and you know, and has will probably be require a lot more rigorous things than the Chicago Climate Exchange has had to do because it's not a regulatory program. Is there a specific thing maybe that you're interested in, or?
No, really. What I was interested in is just how this arose in the first place and how participants come to be involved, and just what the rationale for this as a basically a private enterprise is.
Well, Representative Hilty, I think that there is just a strong has been a strong interest on the part of the people that started the Chicago Climate Exchange, and now the gentleman's name is not coming to mind, but a real belief that it's private markets that are needed to solve this problem, that it is so large that the only way that we're going to solve it is if we turn government or we turn business around in such a way that it will start paying for this to happen. And so they have a strictly private market approach rather than a government or a quasi-government or whatever. And it's been very interesting to see what private markets would do. But lacking a regulatory program to back it up that says you have to do it, it can't achieve nearly as much as it could if there was such a cap.
I guess part of my question is simply, how does it achieve anything at all without any kind of regulatory framework?
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Osmond.
Well, Mr. Chair, just in response to Representative Hilty, there is, because of the federal protocols, there are companies that are international in scope that are needing to demonstrate that their products or whatever they're producing is carbon neutral. And so that gives the market to where they're looking for a place that they can have a contractual arrangement where they can actually get that carbon sequestered, even though it may not be possible through their particular operation because of technologies not being available or whatever it may be. And so that starts getting you the incentive for people to want to use the private system in order to try and develop that. And I think it's especially exciting when we start thinking about how some of these lands in the state of Minnesota can become carbon sinks and could be a future cash opportunity for landowners, because when you couple that with the potential new cash crops that we're looking at being able to grow, especially on marginal lands, you start figuring out that, you know, as government dollars become more and more limited and it's harder and harder for us to provide conservation, there's real potential that we'll be able to see the private needs helping to pay for some of that conservation and implementation, even though through the best management practices we may actually harvest it at some time and create energy. So it can be one of those win-win-win type of situations that if you get into that creative thinking mode, it really gets to be pretty darn exciting.
Well, thank you. And now you see the potential here as well to again, as far as cellulosic ethanol, those types of technologies, there's still a lot of kinks that need to be worked out yet. So there's not a ready market available for the grasses that would be necessary. And this is one way, it seems, that we could create a market which would lead to the planting of these grasses. So.
We may have a potential answer. Mr. Peterson, would you enlighten us briefly, if you would be willing? Happen to have in the audience the president of the Minnesota Farmers Union, former representative and good friend,
Mr. Chair Peterson. And chairs and committee, Chicago Climate Exchange, as I understand, is based on the soil science. It was created by a nonprofit group and work on a cap and trade program. In order to be an aggregator or a company that takes carbon tons and sells it on the exchange, much like the commodity market, like corn and soybeans would be, there are a couple organizations within this state and also within the internet, but I know that the National Farmers Union, represented by Minnesota Farmers Union, also the Iowa Farm Bureau, are aggregators that sell on the Chicago Climate Exchange. And in exchange, you have to be able to aggregate about 175,000 tons in a block to sell. They're sold once a year. The other part about carbon sequestration, it's traded yearly. And it flexes on the market, much like corn and soybeans, like I have mentioned. The unique part of it is there's not a government program. There's no taxpayer dollars involved. It's a program that exists on the cap and trade, like we talked about. But the other part of the program is that the practices that are there are researched by the soil science behind the Chicago Climate Exchange, and then paid on the amount that the actual carbon sequestration or the sink is within that practice, whether it be the reduced till, methane digesters, wind towers, agroforestation. There's lots of practices that do qualify on that. And how it's regulated, I think that was one of the questions, is that there are spot checks, like any farming program might be through the government. There are actual people that go out and spot check the signed up lake, those acres, and a contract has to last from 4 to 6 years. So it can't be something that is in 1 year and out the next year. There's an administration fee that is charged, about 10%. What else can I tell you? That's about it, just off the top of my head. And I was sitting here listening to this stuff. It's pretty good stuff. And the professors, I'm just the old farm boy, so don't worry about it.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank
Mr.
you.
Peterson. Any further questions at all? Well, thank you so much. And it's been very informative and very helpful as we move along setting policy on these issues. So we appreciate it very much. And we'll be meeting next February 15th. Meeting adjourned.